is the news.
The European Environment Agency says fine particle air pollution accounts for more than 300,000 premature deaths on the continent every year. And Austria is set to begin a lockdown for people not vaccinated against COVID-19, the first country in the EU as it is fighting a record surge in cases. The Yemeni government has criticized the killing of 10 Yemeni prisoners by Saudi mercenaries in the port city of Hodeidah. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed that matter with our guests.
The Yemeni government has condemned the execution of 10 prisoners of the army and popular committees by Saudi mercenaries in the port city of Hodeidah. The head of the Committee for Prisoners Affairs of the National Salvation Government said he has precise information about those behind the execution. Abdul Qadir Murtaza added that Yemen has submitted a protest note and a report to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights and the International Committee of the Red Cross regarding the execution. The Yemeni committee, in a statement, slammed the killing of the prisoners by a firing squad on Saturday. It said, quote, such a brutal behavior is against the most basic human rights. It also stressed that such acts are a scandal by the mercenaries and their backers, including Washington and Riyadh. Joining us is Edward Corrigan, international lawyer and political analyst from London, Ontario. And we also have Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from the British city of Bristol. Gentlemen, welcome. Edward, I guess I'll start with you as an international lawyer and just checking the legalities of all this. The summary execution of POWs, is that a war crime?
Most certainly it is. You cannot execute prisoners for no legitimate reason. And there's, as far as I know, there's been no express charges. They seem to be, you know, just prisoners of war. And you have to guard prisoners of war under the Geneva Convention, and it clearly is a war crime. So, and you have, you know, also we're stepping away. This is, I guess, a civil war, where you've got actually, you know, not one but three competing governments, all claiming to represent Yemen. The government that controls Sana'a, the former capital, is, you know, the Ansarallah movements and the Hutus. And, you know, they took over the city whenever Hadi abandoned, resigned, and left the country. Now the Saudis are trying to push him back in. And, of course, there was Abdullah Saleh before that, who actually died in the war. So you got three competing factions. And then there's a section down in Aden that wants to break away what used to be southern Yemen from the main part of Yemen. So they're all claiming to be the government. But it clearly is a war crime. You cannot execute prisoners. And it's also, the timing is very bad, because there is talk of you know, peace negotiations going on between the parties, and this is just like throwing, you know, gasoline on a fire, or maybe even nitroglycerin into
right.
a fire.
Tony,
that's right.
Let me put my question. Can I give you
my thoughts on this story? Because I think the key point here is, We know from the Saudi record that the regime there is not really representing the population. And we have had here in the UK today a very important annual ceremony in Whitehall at the Cenotaph, with hundreds of soldiers and veterans, including Prince Charles, the heir to the throne, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, the leader of the opposition, all the heads of the British Armed Forces, paying tribute to the fallen so-called heroes of the British past. Now, I think that this was a completely justified ceremony to take place. back in the days after the Second World War with the defeat of Adolf Hitler by the Russians mainly, but also the British too. But when it comes to today, the British are actually contributing to the misery in Yemen. And to have mainly through arms companies and arms sales, but also through the British Armed Forces actually assisting the Saudis in the cowardly bombing campaign of this the poorest country in the Middle East. So I think what we're witnessing now is a kind of turning around from the heroes of the previous World War II, and this actually is understood by many Brits too, that the actions of the West in Yemen have been absolutely so desperately appalling as to turn these tributes to previous fallen soldiers from the Second World War, etc., into actually rather hideous parodies of the sort of thing that they're supposed to be. And the actions of the Saudis in Yemen, the British are very, very much in bed with the Saudi government. In fact, it would be probably very difficult for the Saudi regime to carry on if it wasn't for support from the United States and Britain, because there's very little genuine support. But most of the support from the population comes through either through bribery from money, because of the vast amounts of wealth that the ruling family, the royal family, control, or fear of speaking their mind, etc. So I think it's quite clear about rights. I think we need to be talking about things like right and wrong, good and evil in these sorts of situations, because that's what I see playing out. And slowly but surely, those wicked countries that are perpetrating wars, that are trying to steal resources, control the world through fear and bombing campaigns, this kind of thing, are being clearly shown to be who they are. For example, the Russians are not doing this, the Chinese are not doing this, the Americans and the Brits and the Saudis are, and the Israelis. What I see is a potential conflict coming down the line between Arab countries and Israel, which is effectively a kind of crusader state set up by the British and the Americans after the war. So I think particularly these kinds of incidents need to be prosecuted very, very well. We will hear virtually nothing about this in the Western press, because for them it's the wrong story and it shows the lie of the British support for the Saudi government.
Let me thank our guests for their contribution. Edward Corrigan, international lawyer and political analyst, joining us from London, Ontario. Tony Gosinger is an investigative journalist, joining us out of the British city of Bristol. And that brings an end to this edition of the News Review.
The leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khaled Batarfi, admitted that the group's terrorists have fought the Yemeni army in 11 fronts across the country. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali, has more.
In an interview released by al-Qaeda's media, the leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khaled Batarfi, admitted that the terrorists have been fighting forces of Yemen's Ansarullah movement on 11 fronts. Batarfi said the role in fighting the Houthi fighters is clear and no one can deny it. This raises a fresh speculation about the cooperation between the Saudi-led forces and the al-Qaeda terrorists, previously reported by media, including the 2016 battle for Taiz.
Al-Qaeda leaders' confession of their participation in the battles against the Yemeni army confirms our earlier remarks that there is a strategy taken by the Saudi-led coalition using terrorists to support its mercenaries, and this confession may be through which the al-Qaeda leader is trying to prove their presence and that they have a role in a battle that has been going on for years. We will continue to liberate all Yemeni lands from terrorist organizations, whether in Marib or elsewhere.
Experts say the U.S. has been using and supporting terrorist groups in Yemen since the beginning of the Saudi-led war, just as it has supported the Saudi war on Yemen. They say the Yemeni army has proven this by seizing caches of weapons bearing USAID logos in al-Qaeda arms depots.
The U.S. is the main supporter of Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and all terrorist organizations, and it seeks to control the countries in which the terrorists are present. When it comes to Yemen, Al-Qaeda failed in this, and the Yemeni army managed to expel the terrorists from their main stronghold in Al-Baida Governorate. The Yemeni army found tons of U.S.-made weapons in Al-Qaeda's warehouses in Al-Baida, and this is another proof that the United States is the main supporter of terrorist organizations.
Earlier this year, Yemen's interior ministry also said Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's Marib province, where the Yemeni army is pressing ahead with a liberation offensive, which Riyadh denied.
The statement by the Al-Qaeda leader shines a new light on how the Saudi-led war has helped prop up terrorist groups in Yemen with the help of the U.S. Yemenis, however, believe that their army will eventually liberate the entire territory of their country from terrorist groups and occupiers. Abdul Latif Al-Washal, Sana'a.
The Israeli Ministry of Military Affairs has, for the first time, opened its pavilion at the Dubai Air Show, which kicked off on Sunday and will last until Thursday. Eight Israeli companies are displaying their products in the event. Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said their participation reflects the deepening of relations between Tel Aviv and Abu Dhabi. The Israeli Air Force commander also traveled to the UAE to participate in the Dubai International Air Shows or Air Chiefs Conference as part of the air show. Gantz and other senior military officials are due to visit the air show this week. In September of 2020, the UAE and several other Arab countries signed a U.S.-brokered normalization deal with Israel. Palestinians condemned the deal as a stab in their back and or in the back of their cause against the decades-long Israeli occupation. Other and solidarity activist Joe Catron says economic motives were the main reason behind the UAE's move to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
I mean, I think ultimately it seeks to advance the economic interests of its wealthiest citizens and its rulers by increasing cooperation with both regional enemies like the State of Israel and their international sponsors in North America, particularly the United States, and Western Europe. This is simply a matter of them looking out for the bottom line, as we say in the United States, of making deals, which is something that's been taking place quietly, but is now we see for the first time publicly.
The European Environment Agency says fine particle air pollution causes over 300,000 deaths every year on the continent. A report by the agency says premature deaths by the invisible killer have fallen 10% annually across Europe, but it says the fatalities recorded in 2019 could be cut in half if the air quality guidelines from the World Health Organization were followed by EU members. The agency says air pollution remains the biggest environmental threat and is blamed for most premature deaths caused by heart disease and strokes. According to the WHO, air pollution causes 7 million premature deaths annually across the globe. Austria has become the first European Union member to announce fresh COVID-19 restrictions for unvaccinated citizens amid a record spike in its daily infections.
We have decided today that from tomorrow at 12 a.m. on Monday, a lockdown will enter into force in Austria. It means movement restrictions for anyone older than 12. I must say we're not taking this step with a light heart, but unfortunately it is necessary.
Chancellor said the unvaccinated people can only leave their homes for reasons like working or buying food. That would effectively put some 2 million people in lockdown, as about 35% of the Austrian population remains unvaccinated. Following the announcement, people gathered outside the chancellor's office in the capital, Vienna, to protest against the measure. The EU is once again turning into a hotbed for the COVID-19 outbreak. Several European nations have been posting higher figures over the past few weeks. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell and Belarusian Foreign Minister Vladimir Makey have spoken directly about the migrant crisis for the first time. Borrell and Makey talked on the phone about the precarious humanitarian situation at the Belarus-Poland border. In a tweet, Borrell said the current situation is unacceptable and must be stopped. The top Belarusian diplomat for his turn, noted that any sanctions by Brussels on his country would be counterproductive. The EU is preparing to impose sweeping new sanctions over alleged human trafficking by Minsk. Thousands of migrants, mostly from the Middle East, are camped out on the Belarus border as Poland refuses to let them enter the EU. Western countries accuse Minsk and Moscow of engineering the crisis, but the two capitals blame the West for the problem. Now, a photo exhibition on the Arba'in pilgrimage has kicked off in the Italian capital, Rome, showcasing the largest peaceful gathering in the world. It is the first time that such an initiative takes place in Italy. Max Civili has that story.
A two-day photographic and film exhibition on the annual pilgrimage of Arba'in began in the Italian capital on Saturday. Arba'in marks the 40th day of the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Imam of Shia Muslims. It is commemorated annually through a march being the biggest in the world and known as Arba'in Pilgrimage from different countries to Kabbala and holding ceremonies in the Iraqi city. The photo exhibition, organized by the Imam Mehdi Islamic Association and the NGO Arba'in Travelogue, showcases a selection of photos from the world's largest gathering in late September this year. The main focus of the initiative is global justice.
We do our best to bring the message of Arba'in to Europe, to every country, to every city, to each one of those people, and say the truth that Arba'in is follow the global peace, global justice. And global justice, global peace, global empathy is what we're missing now.
There is an amazing atmosphere in Kabbalah. Iraqi people welcomed us the best way they could. The first time I went there, Saddam Hussein had just been removed. I traveled all the way from Iran to the Holy Shrine. It was an unforgettable experience.
Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, hundreds of thousands of Shia Muslim pilgrims converged on Kabbalah in late September to commemorate the end of the 40-day mourning period for the death of Imam Hussein.
People at the photo exhibition say Arba'in should be seen as a model for our societies, one in which each and every one of us has a role, irrespective of our nationality, financial status, and ethnic or religious background.
I think it would be really nice to take it as a model because you see that everything is there organized by people who are doing their best without any rules, without any fines, without any pushing from the outside. So it can be implemented to our daily life. And hopefully I would say that the people could be inspired by it and try to have it in their daily life as much as possible.
What happens during the Arba'in can inspire our societies. Generosity, sacrifice, selflessness, these are values that better our societies, and that's what we should all aim at.
Some 14 million worshippers attended the Arba'in in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
That's your world news for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
the limelight.
Not a single day passes without a Palestinian tree or an orchard being set ablaze or cut down. Clearing the Palestinian environment is, and has always been, the prerequisite of constructing or expanding Jewish settlements. For these colonies to be built, countless trees have to be removed, along with the Palestinians who have planted them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ramzi Barut, journalist. This article is titled, How the Israeli Regime Occupation Ravages the Environment in Palestine. Stay tuned for more. Those who are not familiar with how the Zionist regime, particularly the Zionist regime military occupation of Palestine, is actively and irreversibly damaging the environment, might reach the erroneous conclusion that Tel Aviv is at the forefront of the global fight against climate change. The reality is the exact opposite. In his speech at the UN Climate Change Conference, COP26 in Glasgow, the Zionist regime's right-wing Prime Minister Naftali Bennett pushed the Israeli brand of innovation and ingenuity to promote clean energy and reduce greenhouse gases. The Zionist regime uses this particular brand to sell everything, whether to promote itself as the savior of Africa, to help governments intercept fleeing refugees, to push deadly weapons in the global market, or as Bennett has done in Scotland, supposedly save the environment. Just before we hastily dismiss Bennett's rhetoric as empty words, we must remember that some are actually buying into this Israeli regime propaganda, one of whom is the American billionaire Bill Gates. The day following Bennett's speech, Gates met with the Zionist regime prime minister on the sidelines of COP26, to discuss the establishment of a working group to study potential cooperation between the Zionist regime and Gates Foundation in the area of climate change innovation, the Times of Israel newspaper reported recently. According to the newspaper, Gates, who had asserted in his meeting with Bennett that only innovation can solve the problem of climate change, said, "That's really what Israel is known for." Gates' obsession with innovation, however, might have blinded him from addressing other issues that the Zionist regime is also known for, namely, being the world's leading human rights violator, whose horrific track of record of racial apartheid and violence is known to every member of the United Nations. However, there is something else that Gates might also not be aware of. The systematic and purposeful destruction of the Palestinian environment, resulting from the Israeli regime occupation of Palestine and Tel Aviv's insatiable appetite for military superiority, thus constant innovation. Every act that is carried out to entrench the military occupation consolidates the Israeli regime's colonial control, and expanding illegal Jewish settlements directly impacts the Palestinian environment. Not a single day passes without a Palestinian tree or an orchard being set ablaze or cut down. Clearing the Palestinian environment is, and has always been, the prerequisite of constructing or expanding Jewish settlements. For these colonies to be built, countless trees have to be removed, along with the Palestinians who have planted them. Over the years, millions of Palestinian olive and fruit-bearing trees were uprooted in the Zionist regime's constant hunger for more land. The soil erosion in many parts of occupied Palestine speaks volumes of this horrendous ecocide. But it does not end here, of course. For hundreds of illegal Jewish settlements hosting a population of more than 600,000 settlers to survive, a heavy price is being exacted from the Palestinian environment on a daily basis. According to the thorough research of Ahmad Aboufu, an independent legal researcher with Al-Haq Rights Group, illegal Israeli settlements generate around 145,000 tons of domestic waste daily. Aboufu reported that in 2016 alone, around 83 million cubic meters of wastewater were pumped throughout the West Bank. Moreover, the Zionist regime has near total control of Palestinian water resources. It relies on the occupied West Bank's aquifers to supplant its need for water while denying Palestinians access to their own water. According to Amnesty International, the average Israeli receives 300 liters of water per day, while a Palestinian receives a much smaller share of 73 liters. The problem is accentuated when the water usage of illegal Jewish settlers is taken into account. The average settler consumes as much as 800 liters per day, while entire Palestinian communities could be denied a drop of water for days and weeks, often as a form of collective punishment. The issue with the water is not just that of outright theft, denial of access, or unequal distribution of water resources. It is also that of the lack of clean and safe drinkable water, an issue that has been highlighted by international human rights groups for many years. The result of these unfair policies has forced many Palestinians to purchase water brought by trucks at prices ranging from $4 to $10 per cubic meter. Amnesty International found, highlighting that for the poorest Palestinian communities, water expenses can at times make up half of a family's monthly income. As bad as the situation may sound, the plight of besieged Gaza is much worse than that of the occupied West Bank. The tiny and overcrowded strip is the perfect example of the Zionist regime cruelty. 2 million Palestinians live there while being denied the most basic human rights, let alone freedom of movement. Since the Zionist regime military blockade on Gaza in 2007, the environment of coastal region has been in constant deterioration. With little electricity and with bombed-out sewage plants, Palestinians have been forced to dump their unprocessed sewage into the Gaza. Gaza's underground water is now polluted to the extent that 97% of the available water is now undrinkable, according to the United Nations reports. This is only the tip of the iceberg. From the destruction of Palestinian wells, to the poisoning of trees, to the demolishing of entire ecosystems to make space for the Zionist regime's apartheid wall, to the use of depleted uranium in its various wars against Gaza, the Zionist regime has been on an unrelenting mission to ruin Palestine's environment in all of its manifestations. Those who are hurting the planet have no right to claim the role of being its survivors. The Zionist regime in its current violent regime is the enemy of the environment, and this is what it truly should be known for. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali and Sayyid Abdullah Musawi. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So this series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with an analysis on the important points addressed by the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And in this new series, we are concerned with the topic humans or human beings in the speeches of the leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. So we believe the principles of Western humanities originate from the materialistic thought, and this has been clear to anybody who has read the history of Renaissance and anybody who has become familiar with the people of that era. So when the Renaissance becomes the source of different transformation in the West, then the role of the people and more the materialistic, this mundane life comes to the pin, and it has affect all the arenas of the Islamic humanities, like psychology, sociology, philosophy, communication studies, and all that. And based on that, there comes the secular system. So now, from the other side, we have this the role that the human and the human beings and the position that the human beings has in Islam. You know, on different occasions, in the verses of the Quran and the Hadith, it is the direct reference of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imams. You know, here and there, referred to the role that the human in humanities has. So, again, there would come up a problem like we had in Islamic democracy. That can we have any Islamic humanities, Sayyid Abdullah, or not?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-lain al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If you refer to humanities being a branch of knowledge that consists of knowledges that deals with the human being,
yes.
Sort of example in terms of chemistry, physics, and medicine, and I don't know, all these arts that the human being requires in his life, then yeah, Islam has its own humanities.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, Islam, when we say humanities, in the example that I gave, maybe some of them are not precise.
Yeah.
But let's say anything
that tries to
elevate the human being in whatever way, whether it's through knowledge or through whatever things that he needs in his life. Islam as a system has already also incorporated all these humanities within Islam.
Yes.
So they're already there. And Islam defined the human being, and he said there are two types of sciences. This is, as we call it, ilmul abdan.
Yes.
The sciences of the body,
yes.
Wa ilmul adyan, the sciences of the religion.
Yes.
So the human being needs to deal with his body and he needs to deal with his spirit.
Okay.
So Islam brought both knowledges and he combined them together and he says, well, okay, in the same time that we need to look after your body, through whatever science is required, we also need to look after your spirit, wherever is required.
Yeah. Yes.
Now, this is the Islamic model. Now, the secular model completely ignored the spiritual aspect of the human being and they concentrated heavily on the materialistic aspect of the human being. So let us just try to find whatever makes us happy and pleases us, and we go with that.
Yes.
And obviously we have an issue with that. That's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Again, when we talk about humanities in the Islamic terms, the divinity comes into the scene. I mean, a person who has this fitra, and here I think we have to differentiate between the very fitra which is believed in human beings, which is divine, as the Muslims and the Islamic theology believes, and the nature that is in the Western world, isn't it? Brother Ali, somehow differentiate between these two for us, because when we say human, you know, has a tabi'ah and this fitra.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Knowledge and science has been actually respected by different classes of people, not only in this arena, but even in the course of history in the past. And among the knowledges, usually the scholars of the humanities and human sciences were the one who were leading, actually, or who have the key role in societies. And they have actually the ones who played a great role in the societies.
That's right.
That is, they were the key figures in actually the leadership of the societies. Mm-hmm. So sciences like that of management, I don't know, from economics, psychology, and other sciences which relate to the human sciences.
Philosophy, religion,
language,
art, English, whatever.
So, you see, these scholars usually need to be looked at, I mean, in details. So we see that these sciences or knowledges are going to be regarded as important because they were very important. And what is the key difference between here in this worldview that we are talking about, I mean Islamic worldview, and the kind of look that, for example, other schools have towards it?
Yes.
In this school, actually, in the Islamic school that we are talking about, actually, both sides of human, as Sayyid actually pinpointed, are looked at. That is, the material aspect of human and spiritual aspect of human being. Rather, in the other schools, only the materialistic aspect of human is valued and respected. Look, in an economics, what is the philosophy of this knowledge when it comes to show itself and its result and outcome in the society? This is the priority of profit and benefit of a person or a certain group of people.
Yeah, into liberal capitalism in the Western world, that's right, okay.
But when we are talking about economics, we are talking about equality among different classes of people, even different people, different groups of people, and even the right of every single people is important here. So equality is looked at, and equality, and what is the outcome of it? To practice equality and justice in order to prepare the people for the worship of God, to put them in the right way to worship God. So then, again, everything is going to refer to God, to God himself. When we are talking, for example, about management, we are going working for the betterment of the life of the people.
Yes.
Again, what for? To prepare them to be good servants of God, worship God, to obey God well in the right way.
Way we have to develop our own fear.
Yeah.
Is it?
When we are talking about Islamic psychology, it means that we are paying attention to both sides of human aspects, that is, a spiritual part of him and also material aspect. So when you believe in the existence of soul and ruh in a person, then you know how to cure. Look, the same way that you cure the body of a person as a physician, as a practitioner, then you know, I mean, as a scholar of, let's say, psychology, Islamic psychology, how to cure the soul and the nafs of a person when it faces the problem.
So, and do you believe in this combination of the terms, for example, Islamic physics, mathematics, chemistry, philosophy, or something like that?
I myself actually have a comment on this, and I really do not agree with that, because I believe that Islam by itself is something beyond this knowledge that we do. To attribute it to, for example, psychology and to, I don't know, economics, because Islam has its own word. I mean, these terminologies are something which are quite common among people. Then in order to make it more understandable and closer to understanding, actually I enjoyed these words and employ these words. But basically I believe that whatever ilm al-nafs is something even beyond the psychology that we are talking about. So when a person is a master of ilm al-nafs, so he can naturally cure all the diseases of ruh and nafs. So, and also in the economy, Islam has its own word to say, to call it, for example, Islamic economy, and to even compare it to what Western economy is. No, this is not what actually I really myself believe in.
And different scholars have tried their best to extract new rules and ideas from, especially Islamic studies. Shahid Assad, Muhammad Baghir Assad, in the book Iqtisaduna wa Falsafatuna, you know, has tried to give the new theories that are rooted in the religion of Islam, really nice efforts, Shahid Mutahari and Allama Tabatabai too. But the case is that, so in this way, we need to develop our own theories, Sayyid Abdullah, isn't it?
The theories
are over there, we have to apply them.
See, when we look at humanity studies, or humanitarian studies from a Western perspective, an Islamic perspective, there's one major difference here. Now, if me and you, we have to give a theory, it has to be based on Islam or what pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
Now, so, for example, if we look at psychology, if we look at philosophy, we have to revolve around God and religion, yes, right? And from their perspective, not from my perspective. When you look at the Western or the secular humanities, it is from their own perspective. So each philosopher that comes, yes, each psychologist that comes, each therapist that comes, he gives his own definition. For example, look at Freud. Mm-hmm. Freud says the sexual tendencies in a child, oh, he has sexual tendencies towards his mother.
Yes.
Now that's Freud's theory.
Yes.
Now this is not based on God. This is not based on logic. It's based on him.
Yes.
And it became a study, and all the rubbish that he came up with,
yes,
it became a study. It's been taught in universities.
Yes.
Darwin's theories, yes, they became a
also
study.
They have been criticized, brother, by the Western world too, isn't it? I mean, because in the neo-Darwinism or the Freud ones, you know, there have been
so some of them being discussed, but yes, I'm saying that even those which they accept, whatever, yes, theories or philosophers, you know, modern philosophers or back day philosophers, whatever theories they brought, it was their own from their own creation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not based on God.
Yes.
It's not based on Islam or what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants.
Yes.
So they would always get it wrong. And even if they get it right, it's just their own opinion. Yes. Where if you look at Islam as a system, even as a philosopher, for example, or as a theologist, or what
as
you
a hakim,
might be,
yes,
it still has to be stemmed and has to go through the guidelines of the rules of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which makes a difference in giving you the results or giving you the answers.
Yes. And you know, during when you look at the history of Islam and all these scholars in different fields of studies, you know, Ibn al-Haytham, for example, you know, Al-Khwarizmi, you know, mathematics, you know, Avicenna, Averroes, you know, Ibn al-Rushd, Ibn Sina, you know, Ibn Sina, you know, all these scholars from different fields of science had one foot in the religion and religious studies, so maybe helping them not to be deviated from the right path. And really brilliant discoveries have been made by them.
So
in the history of Islam,
by the way. So
yeah.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam,
yeah,
for example, he used to have 4,000 students in his majlis, in his lessons, the classes. And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, not only did he teach Islamic studies or tafsir or exegesis, he actually taught physics, chemistry.
Yeah.
He taught even pharmacy. He taught sciences of the body.
Yes.
He even taught what we call extraction and excavation.
Yes.
Astronomy.
Yes.
He taught so many sciences that if we look at them, they're just human things for the human needs, not for the... So Jabir ibn Hayyan, so he's the father
of
medicine and pharmacy and all these things. He was a student of Imam Sadiq alayhi
salam.
So like I said, so even these sciences, Islam did not leave it to chance.
Mm-hmm.
Islam spoke about it. For example, look at the golden manual of Imam Rida alayhi salam in medicine. And until today, it stands still.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So even the Imams alayhi salam, when it came to matters of humanities, they did give their say, which is the say of Islam. And when we take these laws that have been said by the Imams and we kind of expand on them. So, for example, you gave the example of Sayyid Shaheed Sadr and Falsafat in our philosophy and our economy. All his theories, they are very in-depth, but he stems it from where? From an Islamic basis.
Yes.
Which made it very extremely special.
Yeah. We are out of time for today's discussion. We have to cut it over here. Thank you very much. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this program. This is Weird Points. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoria.com/Ian Color of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel, Instagram page, Color of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Afi Amanullah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from home.
Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. The U.S. has inflicted heavy damage on Iran over the past 3 years due to its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal. The United States must apologize, compensate the losses, and compensate for Iran's lack of benefit from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. We now present you an article written by Abdulreza Hadizadeh. The piece is titled, Why Does Iran Say We Do Not Have Nuclear Negotiations? The first step in any negotiations is that the participants must share common views on the issues that will be discussed. The main topic takes center stage and viewpoints on its resolution will be put to consultation by the countries participating in the negotiations. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian and his deputy Ali Bagherikani are seeking to build a common understanding about the nature of future discussions with the 4+1 group through making trips and phone calls with their counterparts. In this regard, the Islamic Republic of Iran stresses that it will not participate in any talks revolving around the nuclear issue and that the country's nuclear program will not be the topic of any future negotiations. But what is the reason for such a position in the talks, which are set to start on 29th of November? The case of negotiations related to Iran's nuclear issue was closed in 2015, and the parties achieved significant results. In the course of the talks leading up to the nuclear deal between Iran and the 5+1 group, the Islamic Republic of Iran faced unsubstantiated and political allegations. The country had also been subjected to attacks and questions that led it to be unjustly accused by Western media. Therefore, Iran had to build the necessary trust to show its goodwill and seriousness. So Iran made large-scale retreats in the field of peaceful nuclear energy before the lifting of sanctions. This issue was strongly challenged inside the country. Critics of the agreement in Iran raised the question of why the Zionist regime is engaged in non-peaceful nuclear activities without being a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. While Iran is not supported by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and even punished in some way despite its membership of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, an extensive cooperation with the United Nations Atomic Watchdog, the IAEA. The negotiations reached a conclusion, and all countries were obliged to honor their commitments based on a specific timetable. according to the nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the International Atomic Energy Agency was responsible for verifying Iran's practical measures at its nuclear sites. Later, in 16 reports, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, confirmed Iran's goodwill and the Islamic Republic of Iran's full implementation of the nuclear agreement. These verification reports proved that Iran's nuclear issue was only a political case brought by the country's enemies and rivals. Iran's full commitment to the nuclear restrictions took place while the administration of former U.S. President Barack Obama violated the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action through various sanctions and pressures. After that, the unilateral and illegal withdrawal of Barack Obama's successor, Donald Trump, from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action completed the unfinished work of the Democrats, and thus the United States practically violated an international agreement as well as the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. Other JCPOA members either failed to provide Iran with the economic benefits of the deal or, like the three European countries, sided with America. Hence, the United States and the European states are accused of reneging on their obligations. After the U.S. pullout from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, the Islamic Republic of Iran exercised more than 2 years of strategic patience to prevent the collapse of the nuclear pact. Then Iran decided, in accordance with Articles 36 and 37 of the nuclear deal, to expand its peaceful nuclear activities and take reciprocal measures in the face of the blatant violation of the agreement. The difference between the political actions of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States of America was that Washington, through its withdrawal from the JCPOA, breached the international agreement and violated the UN Security Council Resolution 2231. While Tehran expanded its nuclear activities according to the mechanisms and methods in the agreement itself to reaffirm its commitment to the failed deal. However, according to opinion polls, the U.S. government's measures seriously damaged and weakened the nuclear deal and significantly increased the Iranian people's distrust towards Washington. Investigation into one JCPOA signatory's violation of its commitments is now the subject of the talks, and other axes of the negotiations will be formed around it, the most important of which are as follows. 1. The Islamic Republic of Iran will by no means renegotiate its previously negotiated nuclear issues. Other subjects such as missiles and regional issues will also be off the agenda of the talks. 2. If the US government allows itself to completely change its policy towards international obligations after the change of each government, it must give the new Iranian government the right to at least oppose part of the Vienna talks under the previous administration and call for the beginning of new negotiations. And 3, the U.S. government's unilateral and illegal move has made the high wall of mistrust between Iran and America stronger and more stable. If current U.S. officials regard as wrong the path pursued in the past administration and they regret it, they should take confidence-building measures right now. Unfortunately, so far, despite U.S. President Joe Biden's criticisms of his predecessor Donald Trump, policies towards the nuclear deal and Iran has not seen any serious change in this regard. Hours after taking office, Joe Biden issued 17 executive orders to annul the previous administration's decisions, but regarding Iran, Biden continued Donald Trump's legacy and strategy. This matter intensified the need for U.S. to build trust. And four, the U.S. has inflicted heavy damage on Iran over the past 3 years due to its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal. The United States must apologize, compensate for the losses, and compensate for Iran's lack of benefit from the JCPOA. 5. Following confidence-building measures, the United States must completely fulfill its obligations under the JCPOA. It must remove visa bans, as well as Iran's Sanctions Act. The Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, and more than 1,500 sanctions imposed on our country by the U.S. government since its signing of the JCPOA. 6. Iran should have ample time to verify the normalization of its trade and the transfer of currency into the country. 7. The United States must commit itself not to violate its obligations with the change of government in the country. Additionally, due to the growing distrust towards the United States, its ability to trigger the snapback mechanism should be blocked and locked. And 8. With the lifting of sanctions and the compensation for damage inflicted on Iran, along with America's commitment not to renege on its obligations again, Iran can take steps to return to the restrictions imposed under the JCPOA, and thus the nuclear deal can be revived. Moreover, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says Tehran and the remaining parties to the landmark nuclear deal of 2015 can reach a good agreement in a short period of time, only in case of a serious and positive approach to the upcoming talks slated to start in the Austrian capital Vienna at the end of this month. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said in a post on Instagram recently, "The Islamic Republic has no intention to be locked in the stalemate remaining from the previous negotiations. I believe that if the opposite side enters in the Vienna talks with a serious and positive approach, it will be possible to achieve a good agreement in a short amount of time." The top Iranian diplomat said it was necessary to once again outline Iran's stance and views about the sanctions removal talks in Vienna, as the date of the negotiations has been finalized. He noted that he held detailed and separate phone calls with the foreign ministers of the 5+1 group countries, that is China, Russia, Britain, Germany and France, recently, and emphasized that the Islamic Republic of Iran would pursue a result-orientated approach to the talks and is determined to achieve a good agreement. Amir Abdollahian emphasized that achieving a good agreement calls for the effective and verifiable removal of sanctions and the return of the opposite side to their full obligations according to the nuclear deal. He said Washington's behavior, including in imposing new sanctions against Iran, has made the provision of its objective guarantees an unavoidable necessity. The Iranian foreign minister noted that his deputy and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, held explicit and useful talks in European capitals in recent days. Hossein Amir Abdollahian further said, "As I have repeatedly emphasized, the administration of the Islamic Republic of Iran will continue the policy on the expansion of balanced ties with countries based on mutual respect and common interests. With seriousness, and is determined not to tie the improvement of bilateral and multilateral economic cooperation to the issue of the JCPOA."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.